Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Monday, January 3rd, 2011. This is the Majority Report. My name is Sam Cedar. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the new year. I hope that your holidays were festive, that everyone is healthy, you didn't overindulge. I did. But it didn't take much for me to overindulge. I was so fried from that last week of 2010, those last week and a half, that it didn't take much. And I was luggage. I needed another day. I needed today to be Sunday. Such as the case. Evan, did you do anything interesting? Dorsey's not here today, incidentally, folks.
Yeah, no, Dorsey needed another day, too.
Dorsey, I got some type of virus. My guess would be the virus is he caught it from like that vodka bug that's going around.
It's very unsanitary, yeah.
Did he? I mean, did you see him? Did you?
Yeah,
you
know, no, he was legitimately out for the count for some undrinking related reason.
I find that very, very hard to believe. But okay, I'll take his word for it. I appreciate the fact that you're covering for him. It's healthy camaraderie in the office. Yeah. What did you do, Evan?
I played a show on the 1st, actually.
Really?
It was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was first.
Wait, on the 1st or on New Year's Eve?
On the 1st.
What did you do New Year's night?
New Year's night, I had a bunch of my college buddies came into town. We spent most of it on a roof in Brooklyn watching the fireworks after midnight.
Wait, there were fireworks?
Yeah, there were. Somewhere in Jersey, somewhere in Brooklyn. Couldn't tell where they were coming from, but.
No, I think we made it. I think we stayed awake. I think Nikki and I stayed awake. Wow, I didn't know. I had no idea there were fireworks. It's been so long since I've been awake at 12:15 on New Year's that. And then you played a gig.
Yeah. On I guess that was what? That was Saturday.
Saturday, yeah. New Year's Day.
You didn't sleep much in between the fireworks and the gig, so.
So wait. So where was what? Did you play in the morning?
No. We played 9 p.m. It was about enough time for everybody to kind of crawl out of their house.
What is the name of your band?
Otsego.
Otsego?
Yeah, after the county in New York.
Okay, fair enough. Where did you play?
We played at the National Underground in the East Village.
Why didn't you say anything beforehand? This is the type of thing you plug on a show like this, where you will get...
Where everybody lives in New York.
Right, there's a fire hazard.
Yeah, you know.
If too many people show up. Welcome to 2011, folks. Very glad that you're joining us. Now it is time, as we are now in the habit of doing, as you know, many of you did not listen to the show. I shouldn't say that. Some of you. It is. I've been told traditionally that podcasts are down during this time of year. And actually, it started to rebound. But it was like during the Christmas days where it was down. And some of you may not be aware, first of all, that I guess I wasn't here on Thursday. I filled in for Keith Olbermann Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Maybe we'll post some stuff, but you can go to the MSNBC.com site to see some of it. I thought it went pretty well. Monday night, I thought I was having a heart attack during the... I told you that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was having a heart attack. It turned out to just be bad gas. And literally, I've still been dealing with...
Oh, no.
The implications of that, believe me, over the weekend. But everything was fine. I mean, it's much less dramatic to have bad gas and know that it's gas as opposed to have bad gas and think you're having a heart attack on national television. Now, granted, it's cable, but it's still national. Having a heart attack on local television,
it's not big
no deal. Big shakes. Not really. But on national television, that's much more dramatic. anyways, you can see it. If you haven't seen it, you can go check it out at MSNBC.com. Maybe we'll post a couple to our YouTube page. There was a couple of things that I was very happy with. I think I got better as the week went on. It's a skill that I don't that I'm learning, and hopefully I'll have the opportunity to exercise it in the future. But one of the things that also happened, I guess it wasn't last week, it was the week before, I went to Michigan because my in-laws celebrate Christmas. And aside from it being extremely confusing for my daughter, did I tell the story about how she thought that Santa Claus didn't come to New York? This is how the conversation went. You know, like, we haven't had to really explain things to Milo that much in the past, and it's relatively complicated. My wife is Buddhist, but she was not raised as a Buddhist. And I was raised as a Jew, and so we figure, okay, let's raise Milo as a Jew because we want her to have some religious identity. She wants to get rid of it when she's older. That's her business. But I see certain values that, you know, religion is a easy vehicle to provide those values. It can also be bad. But anything can be bad. And I just, this is just, it's just easier for me. And we decided, because I had experience growing up as a child and being raised in Judaism, that it would, well, let's go that way. So, but Nikki's parents are Christian, not terribly religious. Mila is also in a dual language program at her public school, which apparently the Three Kings, which I don't know anything about this, but I've heard of the Three Kings. I just didn't realize they were, like, people would talk about them. So Mila is getting singing songs about the Three Kings and the baby Jesus. Knows that that's vaguely related to Christmas, but not quite clear how, because it's all in Spanish.
Right, right.
Thinks that because we go to Nikki's parents' house for Christmas, that Santa is Buddhist. Because she knows that mom is a Buddhist. And then we're in Michigan, we're talking about Santa Claus. She goes, Santa Claus does not come to New York City. And I said, well, Santa Claus does come to New York City. He just doesn't come to our house because we don't celebrate Christmas because we're Jewish. And mommy's Buddhist and they don't celebrate Christmas. And so she says to me, well, I don't want to be Jewish anymore. And I was like, well, I understand that sentiment. That's a decision you're going to have to make a little bit later. But it was, so, you know, I'm starting to sort of just trying to explain this to her without, you know, sort of crushing. I want her to crush the myth of Santa Claus on her own, just like I did, because it's very empowering. My parents would just put up socks. We put up socks over the fireplace. Mm-hmm. We had no tree. And I would hide behind the couch, I think more just to be able to prove my parents wrong. And I would sneak back. You know, there was one, I don't know, I was maybe 6 or 7. And hid behind the couch for about 4.5 hours. And as soon as they were stuffing the stuff in the socks, I jumped out, and I apparently almost, like, killed, like, just killed my dad. He just was so terrible. But that was very empowering. So, anyways, I go to Michigan for Christmas, and my brother-in-law gave me one of the most thoughtful gifts I think I've received from anybody. The 90% of the gifts I received for Hanukkah were just, for sweaters, which was thoughtful.
Some of them look pretty good.
No, I love the sweaters. But I said to Nikki, like, I want sweaters. V-neck sweaters and maybe some sweater vests because I'm ready to move back to the sweater vest. After, you know, 15, 20 years of no sweater vests, it's time for me now to adjust to my, you know, I'm almost in midlife. And, but my brother-in-law, who I was telling about, who went to school in Lexington, Kentucky, I was telling about the Creationist Museum last year, comes back with a book from Journey Through the Creation Museum, and I read it, and I think I'm going to read, I think this is going to be a segment. I'm going to read a page or two of it maybe every show, maybe at the beginning of every week. I'm not sure exactly. I haven't decided. But I'm going to now crank up the music for the segment and read the chapter entitled Culture in Crisis. Understand, folks, the Creationist Museum has been built to essentially attack science and its stranglehold on our society. All the wars that have come from science. So, turn up the music here a little bit. Okay, a little Handel's Messiah. Culture in Crisis. Page 34. Graffiti Alley, the hopelessness and lack of meaning in life as expressed within this alley. I guess this is an exhibit in the museum. It's an alley. It's a dark alley where you are if you don't have fundamental religion in your life. As expressed within this alley, represent what happens when the Bible, our only absolute authority, is taken out of a culture, as has happened in once Christian nations. Charles Templeton exhibit. This exhibit brings to life a sad example of what can happen when the church tolerates the teaching of millions of years of evolution. Oh, and evolution, I'm sorry. Charles Templeton, once a popular evangelist, alongside Billy Graham, abandoned Christianity and wrote a book called Farewell to God. This situation has been repeated millions of times by younger people who are brought up in a church that accepts ideas about millions of years and evolution, unaware it erodes the very foundation of faith. This is basically another way of saying, hey, when people actually get exposed to rational thought, they start to not follow so blindly like sheep. And it takes the interesting perspective that this is a bad thing. Going down Graffiti Alley takes you into Culture in Crisis Room. This room shows where the problem in culture began. A church whose leadership has accepted contemporary ideas about millions of years and evolution is featured. Just the idea of millions of years.
Right, that in and of itself is a problem.
I mean, in some ways, millions of years cannot exist in their worldview, because if the Earth hasn't started but for 6 to 10,000 years ago, what does millions of years mean? It means nothing.
Right, not just the Earth, like the universe.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
The pastor is preaching that Christians can reinterpret Genesis to fit with man's ideas about the age of the Earth. The adults are listening, but the teenage children are not. They see the hypocrisy of such a position that undermines biblical authority. This attack on biblical authority is represented by the wrecking ball smashing into the foundation of the church. Well, they actually have a wrecking ball here and a big hole in the window. The same church families seen in the broken window of the church are seen in the privacy of their home. The teens are really no different from the other youth in their culture today. The girls on the phone discussing a possible abortion. And the boys are shooting up drugs and looking at pornographic websites. When Christian and Christian families no longer promote the absolute authority of God's word, they reap the consequences in the next generation. And then there's a picture of graffiti on the wall. Today, man decides truth, with a red line through truth and like a hip-hop little whatever. So there you have it, folks. There is your moment of the Creation Museum. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking about the Grand Bargain. It's coming, folks. There's another way to refer to the Grand Bargain. It's the Grand FU. We're all going to be screwed by this Grand Bargain. Then it's going to be no bargain at all. But it will be a Grand FU. We'll be right back in just a minute. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Folks, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Now, we've been talking about this in more elliptical terms, but this weekend's array of Sunday bobblehead shows gives us a little bit of insight into what we can expect in the near term. It is projected that sometime around February, I guess, early February, there will have to be a vote to raise the debt ceiling. This debt ceiling was raised five times during the reign of the Bush administration. When George Bush came in, the federal debt was somewhere around $4 trillion. When he left office, it was about $10 trillion. You'll remember that when George Bush entered office, as we were having, and I should make this clear, let me help you out here, because even Evan did not know.
It's true.
And a lot of people, you know, a lot of people don't, people use the words debt and deficit interchangeably. The deficit is the shortfall in the budget that, in this case, our government budget deficit, is the shortfall in the budget on any given year. So, in other words, our revenues are $1 trillion, let's say, and our expenses are $1.5 trillion. We would have a deficit of $500 billion. The national debt is the accumulation each year.
Right.
You borrow money to pay to cover that $500 billion. You also pay interest on that. That goes into our debt. Part of our budget is servicing our debt.
Okay.
So our debt is now up to like $12 trillion or $11 trillion. And it was raised from $4 trillion approximately to $10 trillion. More or less doubled. Maybe it was $5 trillion under the Bush administration. But the difference is that when Bush came to office, we had a budget surplus. We were projecting a budget surplus. Alan Greenspan, in support of George Bush's proposal to cut taxes, primarily for millionaires, they would get the biggest tax cuts, but for almost all Americans, cut taxes. Greenspan went in front of the Senate in a hearing and basically said, I'm worried about surpluses. When you have surpluses, government spends it, and that creates more spending problems. I mean, it's just an absurd line of reasoning, which was fundamentally disproved by the fact that there were surpluses. When Clinton came to office, there was no surpluses. He raised taxes. And we had a booming economy, so revenues exploded. And the Bush administration's solution to the fear of surpluses was to cut revenues. And it was these cuts in revenues and the subsequent recession, those two things, separate elements, may have contributed to each other in some respects, but separate elements, they make up between the two of them about 70% of our deficit, and certainly make up probably at least that much, maybe half that much of our debt, because we had all these years where we were just not collecting the same amount of revenues. And so understand that when states are facing these fiscal crises, it is not because of an increase in spending. Krugman had a piece last week. There has been no substantial increase in federal spending. None. Not measured as, you know, there's been a little bit of a bump in terms of relative to GDP, but that's because GDP has shrunk because of a recession. But actual spending by the federal government has really been basically unchanged, more or less. What has changed is that we've had a decrease in revenues. And that decrease in revenues has grown exponentially because we not only we have a decrease in revenues because we were collecting less taxes, because we had these tax cuts, but we also had a decrease in revenues because the amount of money that people were making was less, and so the amount of taxes they were paying on it was less. And those two things, those two elements, decrease in the percentage that people are paying on their income and a decrease in the income, basically created these huge shortfalls. The biggest hole that the Obama administration put in the deficit was the tax cuts. And we'll get no stimulative effects of those, or just completely minimal. To the extent that tax cuts give you any stimulative effect. Now, unemployment benefits for 99 weeks, up to, you know, we're not going past 99 weeks, but unemployment benefits, I think, went actually for only 13 months in the deal. That will be very stimulative because all that money will be spent. Every single dime of it will be spent, and there is a multiplier effect that it adds, for every dollar spent, it adds $1.40. I think, into the economy. There's some multiplier effect. Tax cuts, much less so, because they're just not spent as quickly and in the same way. And many of us said that part of the problem with this tax deal was that the Republicans were just going to unwind any of the stimulative effects that was going to take place from this stuff by refusing to, or when they passed the budget, they were going to put cuts, or they were going to spend their time threatening to not raise the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling had to be raised 5 times because there is a statutory limit on how much the American government can go in debt. It was raised 5 times under the Bush administration, and now the Republicans are squawking like they're not going to raise the debt ceiling again. Understand that if the U.S. government cannot take on more debt, that means that it cannot service the loans that it has taken out to finance this debt, and would represent the first time in the entire history of the United States when the U.S. government would default on its obligations. In other words, you buy a treasury bill, and somebody wants to cash that, or a treasury bond, somebody wants to cash that in. It's a loan, essentially, to the U.S. government. They pay you back interest. We can't pay that off. That's what the U.S. government, this is the first time that would ever happen.
Even though during the Depression they were able to do that?
There was never, ever, ever a time where the U.S. government defaulted on any of its obligations. Wow. Now, at that time, there was no FDIC for the banks. That's, right. You know. Never. There's never been a time. Now, understand that the U.S. government could also simply print more money. They could just turn on the printing presses. Many people fear that because there's a fear that it may create rampant inflation. But if you don't have a certain amount of money, if you have a certain amount of money that's been destroyed, a certain amount of wealth that's been destroyed in the economy, you're not really in danger for inflation until that wealth has been recouped by the society at large. So we have this now. Lindsey Graham. Oh, excuse me. Please. I think our audio quality is bad enough. Evan, if you need to get something from the closet, just do it before the show. Lindsey Graham is on Meet the Press this weekend. And he is. Now, when Lindsey Graham, this is the one of the reasonable guys, right? Isn't he one of the Gang of 14? Isn't Lindsey Graham the guy who is, with his maverick buddy, John McCain? Aren't these the guys who are the reasonable guys? Now, of course, Lindsey Graham, I think, is up for re-election in 2012, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so.
In which case, he's crapping in his pants because, he has certain things, let's say, skeletons in his closet. He's considered to be not Tea Party enough for a lot of people. And so he's trying to they call him Lindsey Grahamnesty because he was with for immigration reform and whatnot. So he's trying to stretch his bona fides to the Tea Party. And, I think Rush Limbaugh's mad at him. And so here he is. He is carrying this torch, as it were, for the Republicans. This is sound clip number one, please.
You talk about the budget.
Now, I should say, David Gregory on Meet the Press.
How will you vote on the debt ceiling? Will you vote to raise it, which is a vote that will come up in relatively short order?
Right. Well, to not raise the debt ceiling could be a default of the United States on bond and treasury obligations. That would be very bad for the position of the United States in the world at large. But this is an opportunity to make sure the government is changing its spending ways. I will not vote for the debt ceiling increase until I see a plan in place that will deal with our long-term debt obligations, starting with Social Security, a real bipartisan effort to make sure that Social Security stays solvent, adjusting the age, looking at means tests for benefits. On the spending side, I'm not going to vote for a debt ceiling increase unless we go back to 2008 spending levels, cutting discretionary spending.
All right, but let me stop you for a second, Senator. That's a big condition, yeah, just on Social Security alone.
Yeah.
You think Republicans are prepared to follow you in two things you said, raise the retirement age and means test benefits for older Americans?
I would suggest that if we're serious about taking America in a new direction and you're not putting entitlement reform on the table, you've missed a great opportunity to change the course of America's future. And the last election was about change that really will make us something other than Greece. I think Pat Toomey, Rand Paul, and other candidates who are new to the Congress have said during the campaign, everything's on the table when it comes to making America fiscally sound. Let's see if we can find bipartisan reforms in Social Security before we raise the debt limit.
Okay. There's so much horse shit going on in this conversation that it's almost impossible to digest. We all know Social Security adds nothing to the deficit. Nothing. When you hear someone, anyone, talk about reforming Social Security, what you should hear them saying is, we need to complete the circle on this redistribution of wealth from the middle class to the richest Americans. We need to essentially get rid of the statute of limitations on stealing from the middle class. Period. That's all he's saying. It will not in any way impact the deficit or debt any more than just saying, like, let's shut down the government. I mean, it is pure, unadulterated theft. Now, the fact of the matter is, it is far more in the interests of those people who support the Republican Party to raise that debt ceiling than anyone else in the country. The idea that the financial systems would be on the brink of collapse because people wouldn't be getting, buying U.S. bonds. It would destroy the stock market. It would destroy Wall Street. The government could just then print money, knowing that it has to meet its obligations. And the Republicans would pay a massive, massive political price, particularly with their huge corporate backers. So in other words, when you talk about a situation like this, the leverage is all with the Democrats and the Obama administration. If they want it. If their agenda is to A, win politically, and B, protect things like spending levels, like stimulating the economy, and protecting retirement insurance, Social Security. If they want to do these things, they have the opportunity very easily. Chris Hayes said this on this program 3 or 4 weeks ago. He would love Nancy Pelosi just to go to John Boehner, Bonaire, and say, you know what, we hear you. You guys don't want to vote for the debt ceiling? Neither will we. You can do this with the Republican votes. We will honor your wishes. As a show of bipartisanship, we're going to honor your wishes. So here is Austin Goolby. He is the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. He's one of Obama's chief economic advisors. Replaces, was it Christine Romer? Is a long time sort of like he's been in the administration, so he's not anybody new, but he's new to this position and new to this senior position. Here he is on ABC's This Week.
It pains me that we would even be talking about this. This is not a game. You know, the debt ceiling is not something to toy with. That's the if we hit the debt ceiling, that's the essentially defaulting on our obligations, which is totally unprecedented in American history. The impact on the economy would be catastrophic. I mean, that would be a worse financial and economic crisis than anything we saw in 2008. As I say, that's not a game. I don't see why anybody's talking about playing chicken with the debt ceiling. If we get to the point where you've damaged the full faith and credit of the United States, that would be the first default in history caused purely by insanity.
Okay. Now, what's missing from here? I mean, we talked about last week the idea of Dorsey and I playing chicken. And my saying, okay, Dorsey, you ready to play chicken? You get in your car and I get in mine. And he says, okay, let's do it. And then I go, all right, you win. Before we even get in our cars. This is the functional equivalent of Dorsey driving straight at me in my car and me going like, I'm not even going to accept that he's doing that. It is a game. It is a toy. And if you needed proof, Austin Goolsbee, it was right on the other network. Now, the question is, what are you going to do about it? We're going to pretend that it's not a game and that it's not a toy, that it's not happening. This is exactly the exact analogy. I would say the closest thing this sounds to me is Obama getting up there and saying, this is a hostage crisis and our hands are tied.
Yeah, I had a professor tell me once the way to win a game of chicken is to unbolt your steering wheel and throw it out of the window first, because then somebody knows that you're never going to veer away. And it seems like that's how the Democrats are reacting.
They're reacting, but you know what? The steering wheel is still bolted in.
Yeah.
And this is setting the table for capitulation. And I say capitulation because that's the theater of it. But I am now at the point where I do not believe that the Obama administration is not aware of the fact that the Republicans can afford to not raise the debt ceiling less than they can. You could just as easily, rather than having Goolsbee on there saying, like, I'm not going to believe that they're doing this, it's absolutely wrong, which sets up the predicate of, like, we have to be the adults here, as opposed to, we have no control to stop them. We have no ability to stop them. That's what should be said here. We don't, there's nothing we could do to stop them. We could give away the store, but they're determined to do it. But they say they're willing to do this if they do the Social Security. Well, they might as well be saying that we would shut down the U.S. government, too. We can't do that. They know we can't do that. We have no ability to stop them. That's what should be going on here. If you want to capitulate, if you're really that bad at negotiating, you simply say, we don't have the ability to even to make their negotiations that they want. And they know that. They're hell-bent on doing this. They're going to do it. They're going to do it. They're definitely going to do it. They're going to do it, and we're all going to die. And then you make the Republicans either do it or don't do it. And the Republicans lose both ways, and we have stopgap measures. But care of Digby, this is why I think that's all bullshit. Care of Digby, she highlights Wall Street Journal article from January of 2009, days before the inauguration. Obama has a lot of problems, blah, 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 facing him. The harder part will be trying to follow that up by creating what is coming to be known in Obama circles as the grand bargain. They were talking about this before they got into office. Getting everyone to agree to clean up the nation's budget mess in a really big way, one that doesn't just fix the problems being created now, but also addresses the frightening long-term problems America was going to face anyway to pay for Social Security and Medicare in the coming decades. You know, this is the game they always play. They put Social Security in them. We don't have any problems dealing with Social Security. Raise the payroll tax cap. Gone. Boom. Gone. No, what they're really saying is, how do we get those Bush tax cut money that we took from Social Security that was paid in specifically by workers to pay for their retirement? How do we not have to repay that money? How do we continue to get away with the theft? We've driven down the highway. The bridge is out. We don't want to turn back. What do we do? For this grand bargain to work, all sides would agree to sacrifice some part of their agenda. They would agree to pay what would be unhappiness on the part of their special interests. 70% of the American public does not want cuts to Social Security, minimum. Their reward would be a cure for problems everybody knows they're going to have to deal with a few years down the road. Remember, this is the talk of shared sacrifice. Everyone's going to share sacrifice. When all is said and done, the federal government's budget will be an ugly sight to see, north of $1 trillion. This is now, our deficit is $1.4 trillion. This is before Obama gets into office. They know it's going to be north of $1 trillion. Presumably, if you took away the budget, the tax cuts, which add $100 billion at least, several hundred billions, the budget deficit would actually be less than what the Wall Street Journal was predicting before Obama got into office. That will pose both a problem and an opportunity. Now, the opportunity and problem got greater when we made this tax cut deal, didn't we? Nobody would have predicted in January of 2009 that these tax cuts were not going to expire. Nobody. But now we have both a larger problem and, I guess, according to the Wall Street Journal, a bigger opportunity. If the deficit problem is that acute, the case for overhauling government to make it more efficient and less wasteful is also more pressing. Here's where the grand bargain would come in. Like Humpty Dumpty, the budget is going to be broken anyway. In putting it back together, would retirees be willing to accept the idea of having more prosperous seniors pay a monthly premium to receive their Medicare health coverage? Would liberals accept cuts in their favorite social programs? Would conservatives accept the idea of carbon tax? Well, the answer is conservatives didn't accept the carbon tax. Okay, should be end of discussion. Bye-bye. Grand bargain's over. But no, not. No, it's not, actually. We've already done that retirees be willing to accept the idea of more prosperous seniors paying a monthly premium to receive their Medicare health coverage. There's been cuts in Medicare Advantage for health care reform. Healthcare reform is also saving, will ultimately save the government money. Maybe not a lot, but some. Would liberals accept cuts in their favorite social programs? You mean like cuts in, let's say, food stamps, which has taken place. Cuts in layoffs of municipal, federal, and state workers. Freeze in federal pay. Cuts in education. And we've seen these. So now the grand bargain is going to be the conservatives will allow for the functioning of the U.S. government and the existence of the U.S. currency if we now steal from Social Security. Or rather, complete the theft. We are getting so rolled here, folks, and maybe it's happening slow enough, like a boiled frog. I don't know, but it's unbelievable. When you start to hear talk of grand bargain, when you start to hear talk of Social Security retirement age difference, understand what you are hearing is: can we take the tax cuts for millionaires and subsidize those by draining money from Social Security, money that was paid in specifically for retirement insurance, period. That's what that is. And we will chronicle this. And if you ever wanted to know whether or not the Obama administration was on your side, you will see this. It's not a question of bad negotiating skills, folks. There is no bad negotiation here. This is, I think, what we're going to see is a clear indication of what the Obama administration agenda is. They're not as nefarious as Republicans, but they think that they're going to be nicks and going to China. And frankly, when you have a bunch of millionaires or soon-to-be millionaires, because they can run right over to the Citigroup, they don't give a shit about Social Security. To the extent that they know anybody who performs manual labor, or the extent that they know anybody who's out of a job at 55 and just basically biding their time so that they don't have to eat cat food by the time they get to Social Security, they work for them. They work for these people. Yeah, I'm sure Robert Rubin knows somebody who needs Social Security at 67. And that person, maybe Robert Rubin will take care of them. Here's a couple $100. It's Christmas time. Enjoy. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let us transition into our news roundup. This is where I do a couple of quick hit stories just to keep you informed with the bumblebee in the background. Flight of the Bumblebee. There we are. Health reform, more provisions kicking in 2011. Some of the biggest ones is the minimum medical loss ratio for insurers requires health plans to report the proportion of premium dollars spent on clinical services, quality, and other costs and provides rebates to consumers if the share of the premium spent on clinical services and quality is less than 85% for plans in the large group market, 80% for plans in the individual. And this was a requirement to report these in 2010, and now it's a requirement to report to actually rebate. My concern is that these insurance companies will be doing a la carte stuff, and we'll get around it in that way, but in the short term, it could be a good thing. This, again, just has nothing to do with health care, but rather health care insurance. And if you're a senior, in 2011, law will begin to close the Medicare Part D coverage gap, the donut hole. Seniors who reach the donut hole will now receive a 50% discount on brand name drugs. First step in a 10-year plan to fill the hole completely. Seniors will now also receive free annual checkup, screenings, and other preventative care. Combine this with the 26-year-olds can stay on your parents' plan and no pre-existing care for children. More and more benefits of the health care plan. Supreme Court Justice John Roberts wants Senate action on judicial nominations, according to the WAPO. Called on President Obama and the Senate to solve what he called the persistent problem of judicial vacancies. Last Chief Justice to do this was William Rehnquist, who said the same thing to the Republican Senate when it was holding up Clinton's nominees. More than 1,000 dead birds fall from the sky in Arkansas. Don't know why, folks. Suspected that maybe it was trauma, like they flew into some type of like hailstorm or was struck by lightning. This is in Beebe, Arkansas. Meanwhile, another part of Arkansas, like several thousand dead fish showed up that is suspected of disease. Don't know if there's a connection. Little scary. I've seen these swarms of, like a big flock of these birds. It's pretty impressive. I've seen it upstate. You can actually hear their wings fluttering, and it sounds, it's an amazing thing to observe. Not inconceivable that they could be hit, but according to the forestry people, it seems to be some type of blunt trauma. So not a disease, but we will keep an eye on that. And thus is our news briefs for today. Did that in less than 3 minutes.
Well done.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Here's an interesting story that Glenn Greenwald was just on, but I saw Matt Duss report on it from the Wonk Room. Ladies and gentlemen, you understand that Republicans are terrorist lovers. They will come out against the mosque, but they really love the terrorists. Washington Post reported that four prominent Republicans, fucking believable, Tom Ridge, Fran Townsend, former Homeland Security advisor, Rudy Giuliani, and former Attorney General Michael Mukasey. Oh, incidentally, thank you, Robert. Thank you, Chuck Schumer, for Mr. Mukasey. Told a forum of cheering Iranian exiles in Paris that Obama's policy toward Iran is tantamount to appeasement. They demanded that Obama instead take the controversial Mujahideen el-Khalq, or the MEK opposition group, off the U.S. list of foreign terrorist organizations. This organization's been on there since 1997. They participated in, they held out in Iran, they participated in Iraq, I should say. They fought against Iran with Saddam Hussein. They participated in the put-down of the Kurdish uprising.
Wasn't that one of the justifications for going to Iraq?
Indeed. Indeed, they were in fact the one of the only genuine terrorist organization ties that Saddam Hussein had. They were founded as a militant group with an ideology combining aspects of Islam and Marxism. It's described as cult-like. They were despised with the Iranian community because of their allegiance with Saddam. Human Rights Watch released a report in 2005 detailing the group's record of subjecting dissident members to torture and solitary confinement, not to be confused with the U.S. government, which also subjects its prisoners to solitary confinement and torture. The question is, did these four Republicans provide material support for a terrorist organization. In June, the Supreme Court of the United States in Holder v. Humanitarian Law Project ruled that, quote, the First Amendment does not protect humanitarian groups or others who advise foreign terrorist organizations, even if the support is aimed at legal activities or peaceful settlements of dispute. In a case that weighed free speech against national security, the court voted 6-3 to uphold a federal law banning material support. That ban holds, the court said, even when the offerings are not money or weapons, but such things as expert advice or assistance, or training intended to instruct international law or appeals. By attending this forum and lobbying to have this terrorist group, their legal status change, did these people materially support terrorism? And I will tell you something. The idea that these people would do it in France, that these four Americans would go to France and criticize the American government on the behalf of a terrorist organization, J'accuse! J'accuse! En France. I wonder if they used English. Or did they parler français when they said these dastardly things? Incredible. Incredible. In a couple of days, we will have a better sense of what the Senate will do in terms of this filibuster reform. The organizing resolution, the resolution to fix the rules of the Senate for the year, need to be finished in the Senate's first day of work. But this is not a day like we understand a day, a 24-hour period. Senator Reid, as majority leader, can essentially dictate that the first day lasts as long as he wants it to last, more or less. The first working day. It can be calculated in many different ways. So it's not necessarily going to be resolved on January 5th. Walter Mondale, and I should tell you right now, I did read the Walter Mondale autobiography. I think it came out like in 1980. A portrait of a politician by some guy, I can't remember. Something Piccadilly Lewis, or I can't remember what his name was. Strange name. I did read it. I don't remember it, but I assume he was a nice guy. He wrote an op-ed to, you know, resolve, fix the filibuster. And he goes on to explain that he was part of the group that changed the threshold from 67 to 60, reforming Senate Rule 22 36 years ago. They didn't do it via a vote. They did it via a compromise. There's a lot of people who are starting to suspect that Reid is going to do the same thing this year. There's a lot of people who are very afraid of ruling that the Senate can completely rewrite its rules every 2 years with a simple majority. I am one of those people because I think it makes it easier for Republicans, and I do not see any political benefit for Democrats in the short run. I do think that it's possible that the Republicans have simply gone too far as a party, and this is giving them a loaded weapon. Mondale, not one of those guys. Sort of splits the difference. Says they could find on day one that there is no reason for a two-thirds majority, but he hopes, two-thirds majority in changing the rules, but he hopes that they can find a compromise. Sort of interesting. He's threading the needle here. The fact that one Senate decades ago passed a two-thirds majority does not mean that all future Senates are bound by it. Remember, we were talking about the understanding that the Senate is a continuing body. And he's arguing, though, it's not a continuing body. It's a new body every 2 years, even though it's made up of some of the same people, because they're not term limited, or their term is not up. And this year's new Senate could see this constitutional option to force a vote on any change to Senate rules, including Rule 22, and change them with a simple majority. 75, my colleagues and I announced our proposal to amend Rule 22 and threatened to force a majority vote to end a filibuster on the change if the minority tried to block it. In the end, we reached the 60-vote compromise and never had to use the constitutional option at all. A similar strategy would likely work today. In other words, he's setting the table. I suspect the way he's setting this table suggests that a compromise is in the making, which would probably make it less effective. I don't know. I'm of two minds on this. I've talked about it in the past. I'm a little skeptical. Meanwhile, well, they're bringing out the big guns to demonize more state workers. Andrew Cuomo seeking a one-year salary freeze for state workers. It's part of an emergency financial plan he's going to lay out at his State of the State address on Wednesday. 900 state workers were laid off after New Year's Eve. Talk about a freaking hangover. The amount of money that's going to be saved is literally a drop in the bucket with this spending freeze relative to the deficit that is facing New York. But supposedly give him some political capital in this era in which we are demonizing state and federal and municipal workers. You know, over in New Jersey, Bluto, it's Chris Christie?
Yeah.
Is he back from Disneyland?
You know, I don't know.
Didn't he say his wife made him go? You know, I heard that he got the last plane out of Newark, literally. Like, it was, this guy was, like, on the roof of his governor's mansion and was helicoptered away before the storm came. Now, as you know, in New Jersey, there is a massive, massive pension shortfall, which is a function of years of Christy Todd Whitman giving tax cuts to rich people, not funding her pension properly. Unions at that time basically went for pay wage increases instead of going for forcing them to fund the pension. Maybe it was because they felt they didn't have the leverage. To get those pensions, they took not pay raises commensurate with what was going on. Governor Christie vetoed a proposed millionaire's tax this year, foregoing paying into the pension fund, creating a crisis. Local government shed 212,000 jobs last year across the country. A recent raft of studies, according to the New York Times, found that public salaries, are you ready for this, folks? This is going to come as a shock. Even with benefits included, are equivalent to or lag slightly behind those of private sector workers.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
I will repeat. A recent raft of studies found that public salaries, even with benefits included, are equivalent to or lag slightly behind those of private sector workers.
Hey, what happened?
When you start to strip their benefits in addition to cut their pay, they're going to even more significantly lag. The Manhattan Institute, not sympathetic to unions, studied New Jersey and concluded that teachers earn wages roughly comparable to people in the private sector with similar education. What?
Ooh, wow.
That's not possible. Teachers are bad. Teacher unions are evil. They are ruining everything. They're preventing really rich people from setting up charter schools, four or five of which work. Let's make movies about them and present it as if it's true about everything. And teachers' unions are evil. They're making so much money. But what? The Manhattan Institute finds the teachers earn wages roughly comparable to people in the private sector with similar education? No, not possible. I won't believe this until I read it on Fox.com. However, these shortfalls in pensions, folks, are real. They're a function of unions not being strong enough to prevent them from happening. And state governors basically not contributing to these pensions because they can't be trusted to, and using that money to subsidize tax cuts for rich people. Now, in New Jersey, 2,000 union lobbyists persuaded legislators to cut 5 years off the retirement age for police and firefighters. You know, and of course, look, the bottom line is, if you wanted to argue that unions' pay is way out of whack, municipal, state unions way out of whack with everybody else, you would have to look to firemen and to policemen. I'm not saying you should, but that's where the big golden geese are, as it were, ladies and gentlemen. Whether or not you think it is in society's interest to pay firemen who go into burning buildings or cops who get shot at these extra benefits, I don't know. We never hear a free market say, let's just let the market decide. let's just let the market decide. Maybe we don't need to give them these benefits. Let's just privatize cops. Or firemen. Now, of course, Republicans approved a 9% increase in pension benefits in 2001. These are Republican legislators in New Jersey, and of course, giving themselves a huge benefit on their pension. But New Jersey has shortchanged the pension contributions, and that's what you get. That's what you get. So let the games begin. Start to demonize these people. Coming up at the break on the other side, I'll take your IMs. We will talk about this big WikiLeaks story, both that impacts Manning, and maybe we'll go over some of the things we've learned from WikiLeaks this year. Maybe we'll save it for tomorrow. I'm not sure. If you're not a member, you can still listen in on your podcast to the post show, but that's not always going to be like that, folks. In fact, that's going to change. We've yet to set a date, but I think we're zeroing in. I think it's the month of February. So if you're not a member, become one so that you don't miss any of the Sam Cedar juggernaut goodness. Speaking of goodness, I hope you visited justcoffee.coop and got great coffee. Great chocolate, great tea, all fair trade, all with a 10% discount if you put in the coupon code MAJORITY. All right, folks, we'll be here tomorrow. I'll take your IM at Majority FM. Back, it's the post show. I can't remember when this happened. Maybe it was Thursday. But one of the things, one of the battles that Glenn Greenwald has been waging over this WikiLeaks thing, we've all heard that Manning has basically been through kept in conditions that are widely agreed to be torture at this point. Manning, Bradley Manning, being the alleged person who stole and leaked these government cables, sent them to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks then partnered with other publishing outfits and have now published something around 1 to 3% of 250,000 cables, somewhere around like 4,000 cables, maybe a little bit less, in conjunction with New York Times, Guardian, El País, I think a German paper. And there's been rumors the U.S. government is trying to indict WikiLeaks on an espionage charge, but it'd be very difficult for them because they'd also probably have to indict all these other publishing outfits. So one of the things they were trying to prove, they rumored, was that Bradley Manning had a special relationship with WikiLeaks, wherein WikiLeaks actually not simply received these goods, but helped Bradley Manning essentially steal them, which has different implications than if you're the New York Times and you receive the Pentagon Papers. And the foundation for this belief was an informant who delivered, basically blew the whistle on Bradley Manning, delivering to Wired magazine and one other outlet chat logs, instant message chat logs, where he had contacted Bradley Manning, and Bradley Manning had told him about these leaks. And this guy was going around the press. He delivered these chat logs to Wired. Wired printed to about 25% of them with very little reference to the relationship between Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks. And this source, Lamo, I guess his name is, or something like that, who apparently is also sort of a nut job, has been going around and doing press interviews suggesting that there was information in those chat logs which showed a relationship between Manning and WikiLeaks that would put WikiLeaks in a position of maybe being indicted. Does this make sense, Evan?
Yeah.
And Greenwald has been hammering the Wired guys. It is incumbent upon you to release what you know about this, because you've got this guy going around implying that there's information in those logs. You are the only media outlet that has access to those logs. Maybe the Washington Post is rumored to have them too. You're the only one who has said that you have access to those logs. It is incumbent upon you as a journalistic entity to tell the rest of the world to release them, or to tell the rest of the world whether or not this guy Lamo is lying. You're the only one who can prove this. And they're like, Glenn Greenwald, you're a horrible person. You know, classic sort of, I saw one tweet from one of the guys at Wired, like, self-appointed media watchdog Glenn Greenwald. Well, here's a question. Who the fuck is supposed to appoint media watchdogs? I've been appointed by a group of Christian fundamentalists who are paying my salary. I mean, honestly, who's supposed to appoint these? But that gives you a sense of where they're coming from when I see shit like that. So Greenwald's just hammering and hammering and hammering and hammering them like he does. And they finally basically come out and say, there is no reference to the things that this guy Lamo is suggesting in the chat logs we have. Basically proving that Lamo, A, is a liar, and B, that there is no grounds, at least in terms of what was presented in this conversation, which originally led to Manning's arrest, to suggest that there was a relationship between WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning that would allow him to be indicted. Let's go to the IMs. We'll do the How WikiLeaks Enlightened Us in 2010 tomorrow. AOL System Manager. Yes, I know. I'm signed in multiple places. Bush and Chains have a good countdown. That's a little bit late. Thank you. Gatoron. Would Clinton have been more progressive? Two words. Mark Penn. Agreed. Agreed. Mark Penn being Hillary Clinton's chief political advisor. I don't think there's an argument that she would be significantly more progressive. It was, you know, her economic team we were trying to get away from. Mark Penn, even when he was working on her campaign, had to fly down to, like, somewhere in Latin America to help some dictators or something that he was working for. I mean, but it's hard to imagine she'd be much different. And maybe the politics would be different. Who knows? Robert Coates, I thought I'd pass on a story from the London Independent. Don't know if you've read it before. Study took place at the University of College London, which showed right-wingers had a more pronounced amygdala, seat of emotions, while liberals had thicker anterior coagulates, which had to do with empathy. I'll check this out. Oh, you know what else I wanted to talk about, too, was this Gatwick Heathrow. Look that up. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Rob Coates. Matthew, I will be sure. Thank you. Hi, Pop Phil. Interesting, the debt ceiling is something always approved and never messed with, but unemployment traditionally extensions never questioned at 10% has now become a pawn. Exactly. Only in New York City, where 350 didn't to go home, an untold number to sick to breath would say they get too much. Sick to breathe. I see what you're talking about. I think firefighters. Drad Manthes, welcome back, Sam. As we're calling on the break, then in Break Room Live, you started correspondence with a Nigerian scam artist. How did that exchange resolve itself? I like the idea. Would you consider doing it again? Yes, please stay on top of Social Security theft. Far worse than a Nigerian email scam. Someday I'll publish all that stuff. Tim Johnson, a couple of questions, as I understand it. Failing to raise the debt ceiling wouldn't cause a default on prior. It would simply disallow the issuance of new T-bills, causing the federal government not to be able to pay its bills. Correct. The government would grind to a halt. Not sure about this effect on Social Security, Fed contracts. I think you're right when you say the best moves. Okay. Well, it wouldn't cause a default on prior issue bills. It would disallow the issuing of new T-bills. And those new T-bills are what financed the government, and including paying off existing T-bills. So it would cause a default. That said, like I mentioned, the Fed could just print more money. So it's not necessarily as apocalyptic. Maybe we get Dean Baker on here tomorrow and figure this out. I thought I had a piece by him. I guess I didn't. Note to myself. I gotta get something to eat. Can't wait for that $1 lunch today. What about the military? Let the Republicans run amok. Well, I agree with you. Let's see what happens. The Republicans are talking about playing chicken with the debt ceiling because they know the administration won't. They're counting on exactly that take, the take that Goolsbee's making. They're counting on not in anger. But in sadness, take. That's because they fully expect the president to give in to whatever demands they make to protect the full. Yes, exactly. They're insane. And then, okay, yeah, this is from Fire Dog Lake. Yes, exactly. Gravitune, please, Sam. Non-commercial PayPal options. Working on it. Progress moves slow, particularly here, folks. Working on it. Do you find it difficult to try and digest all this news stuff? I'm on the edge of a news shutdown. It's just so depressing. Understood. Maybe we got to do something that's more positive.
Yeah.
People, I know, I've had a lot of people tell me they're doing that, and it's hard to argue with that. But one never knows. Things can change, folks. Happy to see you made the Daily Rumpus email last week. I would have liked to have been a fly on the wall during your date with Stephen Elliott. Oh, yes, I went out with Stephen Elliott the other night. Well, Stephen is good friends. I mean, we've had him on the show. He'll come in and do this show.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Meet him on the Majority Report quite a bit in the past. Back in 2004. Hung out with him at the RNC. Watched Karl Rove hit on him. Went out for a drink after one of the Olbermann shows. And I got invited to his party, but I was just too tired Wednesday night. I couldn't go up. I was too tired. But the Adderall Diaries, James Franco, optioned.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Good for him.
We'll get Stephen Elliott on. Make a note. I'll send him an email. Get him to come in. Sam Cedar, the weatherman, was best thing on SNL since 1975. Dede Fru, thank you very much. Very kind. Don't be a putz. Public sector jobs disproportionately employ minorities relative to private companies. Thus, cutting public sector jobs penalizes minorities. This is not unintended. Racism is still a key component of Republican motive. Good point, don't be a putz. You see Sirota on Radigan, Shonda for the Goyim. Matt Miller was subbing for Radigan. They were talking about the snowstorm where Sirota brought up global warming, and Miller immediately launched into Fox News mode and scoffed at Miller. Miller called global warming a canard. Wow. Todd Slater, Sam just missed about the entire show again. It's this pesky job. They keep wanting me to do stuff. Anyway, I have to catch you later on the podcast. That's fine. Folks, I remind you, if you subscribe on the podcast, do it through iTunes just for heck of it. You can go through another point if you want. And remember, this entire part that you're hearing now will be sequestered on podcast fairly soon. So you can join at majority.fm. Sammy Kammer, love the global warming weatherman. Thank you, CC91. Great job on Countdown, particularly meteorologists and air traffic reporter spots. Thank you. Sent out an email to all my friends to have them watch. Got together with the girls on New Year's Eve day. They agreed they like your style, want you to have your own TV show, and half the group said they liked you better. Ooh. Well, thank you. Thank you. Serengeti, bye-bye Social Security as we know it. By the way, you look very handsome on TV last week. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I have been doing my best to watch my figure, just in case I had an opportunity like that. I, Johnny, wanted to thank the Majority Report crew. I got the free DVD in my mail recently. Ah, you're very welcome. And I should tell you, if you have not received your swag and you have requested it a long time ago, we're sending out the next wave of mailings probably today or tomorrow, so that you should get that soon. And then if you've recently requested new swag, we will get to that soon. And we had, I don't want to scare people, we had someone who was incredibly generous, offering a major, major membership. I'm not even going to say it at this point. I want permission from that. We got a major membership buy-in that literally will, I wrote this person, I said, your membership will, you will see changes, and you will know that, and all members should feel this way. When you start to see improvements in the show, in other words, we're getting ASCAP license, which means that we can have a wide array of music in our podcast. We cut out most of the music as much as we can from the podcast. There'll be more music in the podcast. There'll be more music live. It's a function of members. We have just hired a part-time booker who's going to help with booking. You're going to see better guests. You're going to see more guests. That's a function of your membership. You're going to see improvements in the Sammy Cam. You're going to see a whole raft of improvements that will be a function of your membership. The show will continue. I mean, at one point, I'm going to have to make some money. And that point was 2 months ago. But in the meantime, your membership makes this show possible. It makes it better, and it makes it possible. And I want to thank you. You know who you are. You know how much I appreciate what you're doing for the show, for me, for Evan, for Dorsey. He's waging a strike right now. Evan, by Hoover, we must use the debt ceiling as leverage to cut spending. Rusty Cole, just curious, how many people subscribe to the podcast on iTunes? Let's put it this way. It's not six figures. Five figures. We want it to be more. Oh, yes, John Roberts. Moving over to Fox News, apparently to be closer to his fiancée, Kira Phillips, who works out of Atlanta. So he's moving to Fox News.
I know that.
It's so non-ideological. Mark Green says, hey, Sam, just wanted to let you know you're signed into AM for AM for two locations. You're welcome. Very good. Rob Coates, I should add, I sent an email to Sam Cedar Show last week, my heartfelt request. Don't know if you had a look, but it's not an easy request, but you may have an answer. Was this about Fenton? I'm not sure. I don't have any Fenton Muley pictures, but I would be glad to sign one if you send it to me. Spaff, I only missed one live show ever. Wow, Spaff. Very nice. All right, folks. It is just about time. Oh, well, don't be a putz. Let's see. Wait a second. Looked like Jenk was using your office to Skype into TYT last night. I hope you charged him rent. No, he's trying it out. If we can work out something, we will charge him a little rent. I didn't think the sound was very good. Did you watch it?
No, I didn't get to see it yet.
The sound was not very good.
That's because they don't have me running it.
That could be it. They're also using a lavalier mic.
Yeah, that's true.
And they didn't. The location's not very good. Like where they put the. I don't know. I wasn't terribly impressed. But maybe it looks better on YouTube. I know. We'll look at it on YouTube. Spay F. It was for a good cause, and I hooked and played a steelhead. Oh. Spayoff loves to fly fish. Loves to fly fish. Dane Cook, the man. Has Marin become a member yet? He certainly can afford to with all the pity donations he gets for WTF. Oh. I hope people listen to some of the shows over the weekend. Mila's big news. She's lost two teeth in 10 days.
Wow.
And I was a little worried. But one of them, like, the big tooth is like halfway in already.
Wow.
She's got something with her teeth. Like, I think, and I'm convinced that it's also developmental. When she started, I don't know why I think of Marin. Yeah, no, Marin has not joined, despite the fact that I have a child. And he hasn't come on. I asked him 6 weeks ago. He hasn't come on. He's been busy. He sent me an email saying, like, hey, don't slag me to your listeners, man. Because I didn't come on. I figured you'd be on for a while. Well, that's, you know what happens when you make when you assume. So I'm convinced there's a connection between teeth and mental development. Because Milo's teeth started coming in, and then she started walking. Huh. And it makes sense. Like, if you don't have teeth...
What do you need to walk for?
Right. What do you need to do anything for? You can't ask for food. You can't chew it. Everybody knows the only thing you can do is suck on a nipple.
Yeah.
And, you know, what? You don't want to walk. Why would you want to walk? You can't go to eat anything. You can't bite anything. Teeth. I think that's, and you know what? I can tell that I don't look like that front tooth is coming in straight.
Uh-oh.
Frickin' braces already. Uh-huh. Stinks. deal with that. Don't be a putz. Myla's teeth could be meth. The new ones were already grown in behind the baby ones. When the two fell out, also within a couple of weeks, the new ones moved forward into the spaces in a matter of days. Crazy. My son just went through the exact same thing with the two bottom teeth. Ah, okay. Yeah. Yeah. The teeth thing just it's really disturbing. How old is Myla now? I remember when she was born during the old majority report. That's right. There was actually some talk that I had named her name is Myla Ray. There was some talk that I had named her after the majority report. She is over 5 years old, Rusty. Beacon Shuni, congrats on the big new donor. Are they a majority report member? Will they get to be a Sam for a day or an hour? I hope so. It would be fun if you made a video clip promotion. The quality of your guests are great. I was happy to see some of them during your countdown show. Oh, no. Make no mistake. The guests that we've had on the show, I'm extremely happy with. And we're going to have every single one of them back on multiple times. But it's harder for me to make connection with, like, if there is a book that I want to talk about.
Right.
Or if there's a documentary film that I want to talk about. You know, I don't particularly like talking to politicians. It's useless, in my estimation. But there's an occasion where I want to talk to some. And there are just people who are busier, you know, like, you know, people who are blogging constantly or writing constantly, they have more time for this and they go through more topics. But there are some people like academics and they need long lead time, and that becomes an organizational problem for us. And so make no mistake, the guests that we've had, I think, are fantastic. But I want to broaden the group of people, and it's, you know, it's tricky. And I'm constantly on the search for more female guests, more Hispanic guests, more Black guests, more guests from sort of just other communities that I'm not as normally exposed to. You know, I am exposed to, you know, what I find online coming out of blogs, which tend to be rather generic. You know, like Marcos is Hispanic, but he doesn't necessarily, his blog is not necessarily about Hispanic issues. And, you know, I tend to be a generalist in some respect and tend to find other generalists. You know, but that reminds me of, like, the guys, like, other guests. And if you ever have guest suggestions, by all means, send them to majorityreporters@gmail.com. Some of my best guests have come from suggestions like that. Joe Belisk. Sam, great job on Countdown last week. Any word on there being an ability to get any kind of break on Ring of Fire subscriptions? Oh, I'm going to talk to them about that. By the way, I'm subscribing to Majority Report later today. Okay, haven't yet. Cheers. Well, then I will give you this in anticipation. I've yet to talk to them about that. This will be the first week we do Ring of Fire. So thank you, Joe Belisk. I will talk to him about that. We'll see if we can work something out like that. It may not be able to be something that we can work out for like a month. When we sequester this podcast, we're going to be developing a whole membership thing, so we'll have a code, a key code, which will make it easier to do something like that, I would imagine. So we'll talk about it. If it happens, it won't happen for a couple months. But that's a great idea. A great idea. All right, one last one. Don't forget the homos, says Cry Pop Phil. Yes. I mean, I feel like I have more access to that community just through guys like Aravosis and and frankly, I think, like, gay issues are far more prominent in the media. And I have enough, a foundation. It's not as difficult for me to find people like that. Oh, just teasing, Sam. Oh, I appreciate that. You got me. All right, folks. See you tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. Just in case you're wondering, tomorrow will be Tuesday. Until then. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the lie.